Mr. Hayes, Reel 11. We're talking about your time when you were with the 2nd 544 Yeomanry Headquarters Squadron and at Bredstead. Now, just before you went to Bredstead, there will have been the time when the VE Day came. Were there any sort of celebrations or anything?
No, it just fizzled out as if nothing.
No celebrations?
No, no. I suppose people were so relieved that it ended, you know. They were still all in one piece. There was one instance that happened in that particular part that is in none of the war music, war memorial, the writing of the war. It was somebody that got killed a couple of days after, so he wouldn't be in, you know, killed in action sort of thing. And I'll show you his photograph in the page, in that picture in a minute. And I never knew his name. He was just called Big Adam. And he was a giant of a man, very, very quiet. And A Squadron, who was the squadron Stan was with further down the road, they had the job of keeping an eye on a Polish village. You know, displaced person, but it was the whole village of them. And Adam was given the job this particular day of taking a wedding party of the Poles down through Bredstead itself to another village. And I was on guard at the time at the bottom end of the village, and they'd come up and they'd gather things to you. And anyway, this woman came up and she's, you know, Jim, so and I thought, what's going on? Oh, it's terrible and all this. And what had happened was that Big Adam had loaded all these Polish people on, men and women. And it was about, you know, you have an awful lot of people standing in the back of one of those 3 tonners. You get about 20 or 30 in. And it loaded them up and went down to the village. A fair sized village it was. And I don't know what, I never knew to this day what happened. Either the tanker, a high octane tanker, hit him, or he hit a high octane tanker. And what it was RAF people taking supplies through to Denmark for the aircraft that we got there. Anyway, it just went up like that. And the only way that the people were telling me after that, when they tried to sort it out, the only way they could recognise Big Adam was the fact that he was the only one that they found a pistol on, you know, Smith & Wesson. Otherwise, the whole thing would just burnt to cinders. And And somebody came up and told me about the atomic bomb dropping.
And that so you were still with the 5 and 4 5,
yeah,
then? Second.
And because it didn't go, the dates in when it actually transferred to the 5th tanks. But they came and said, you know, the big bomb has dropped and the war has ended and such and so forth. And so that fizzled out. But there was the fellow that was with me in that that pub in Potsdam, was a fellow that had come from the first line, and his name was Stan Padgett, and he was a hell of a nice guy, and I shared a room with him, and his father had been in the textile industry, and then long chats together, and he said, after the war, I'll give you the name and address, and he said, any time you want to, you'll be a job for me. Real bloody thing. And he said, in my father's company, he said, and what actually happened to him, he went to Australia and opened up a subsidiary out there. And our Stan said to me, why the hell didn't you write to Stan? Oh, I said, it goes out of your head, doesn't it? And he said he was going to fix it with a job. But he's one of those water under the bridge sort of thing. But the thing that did annoy us a bit was, out of the blue, another regiment appeared, tagged onto our division. And it was either the Household Cavalry, or the, I don't know what it was, one of the Royal, you know, bullshit regiments. And they bypassed a lot of us and went straight into Denmark. And I said, well, what are they doing up there? And they said, oh, there was something good. You know, I looked through all the records of the division, and I never saw them. It was either the Household Cavalry, or the, I don't know what it was, but it was one of the, it was an armoured car regiment, I think. And they were the ones that went up into Denmark. And the thing that used to fascinate me, and it was one of those other strange things, when the war petered out, and we were off the main road in Bredstead, we went from the main road through, and the Germans were marching out of Denmark. And they marched down this road, all marching, no transport. And it used to fascinate me the way the Germans on the march sang. You know, it wasn't rather like roll out the battle like our people. It was almost if you saw the Battle of the Bulge, you probably did, I would think, and you saw the way the Germans broke into song over this, I don't know what it was very inspired in the picture. And this was just the sound that these troops were making. And they sang it in parts. Put one section would start, and then the next that would take it up. And I think what they did, I admire them for what they did. Because the people had been up in Denmark, or maybe Norway for that matter, they didn't march through English troops. We were kept off the road. Not particularly, but because where we were, they wouldn't spot where we were. They were about, I suppose, half a mile off the main road. But they marched all night and day along that road, back into Germany. And you know, sort of at night when you're on guard and you used to listen. And it was a peculiar way they sang Germans on the march. And but then they were laughing at the what's name at the dinner about it, and I said they were in A school, and I was in HQ school, and I said, "Well, God," I said, "you were all right, weren't you?" So they said, "Well, why?" So he said, "Oh, no frat bombers on." I said, "You didn't need them in your compound. You had a strength through joy home in there. All the German girls that were told to have a child for the Reich." And I said, "They were still in there in your compound." I said, "If you chose to ignore it, it wasn't your fault."
What do you remember of the non-fraternisation ban? How did it work, and how did you get on with the Germans in those early months?
You wouldn't think the war had ever happened. They turned like that, just, you know, in a flash. And there was a certain amount of fraternisation went on. There were a few of them, you know, sort of brought up about it. One of our fellows was brought up for fraternising, and he went before a court-martial, and he conveniently convinced them that he was being raped at the time. And they thought, oh, there's no answer to that. But no, it worked out all right. There was very little. It's amazing how they changed their allegiance in such a short time, within a matter of a week. But having said that, I opened up. Obviously, this place had been evacuated in this, and I opened up a door, and somebody sent a nice picture postcard home to Mumma or whatever it was, with a row of corpses on a gallows. I thought, well, that's a nice thing to send home to your parents. I got along with them all right. And then eventually...
Was there much of a black market in Bredstedt? Or were you aware of it?
Only bar making. It was tobacco. And, I mean, we all usually got the best end of it.
What sort of thing would you do?
Well, it was tobacco was the main thing. Because I could get 200 cigarettes sent from England, if my mother went and gave 5 and 6 to the local tobacconist, and I'd get 200 senior service packed and posted to Germany. But it never bothered me that side. There was some of it that were dedicated to it, absolutely dedicated.
So what would you get for your cigarettes?
Well, you'd get at least a mark of cigarette, and I can't remember what the exchange rate was at the time. You'd get a mark of cigarette, you know, for a packet of 20, you'd get 20 marks. And but then was the problem. It was getting that money out of Germany, which was the trick, you know, converting it into, you know. But what we used to do was keep our. You got when you went on leave, you got to show by your paybook that you hadn't drawn. You'd drawn very little until you came on leave, and then you could claim. You could convert all your German money back into, because you'd be spending that as you went along, and they'd take it in the nappy, the German money.
Now, what kind of duties were you doing before you went to the 5th Tanks in October? Because there's quite a period of 4 or 5 months there.
I was turning lard into butter, magic.
So Sorry?
They couldn't get butter for the canteen. So they used to get cases of lard and gradually get a bit of life into it and then put a can of evaporated milk, or maybe two tins, a bit of salt, and then you kidded everybody they were getting butter on the sandwiches. And this went on for some time. But I was doing... Just in, what am I talking about? I'm end of five and fourths. Oh, but I'm still am, I like. Well, I was doing normal transport duties because we unloaded all our ammunition while we were up there. And so we got 3 tonnes to run round, and we used to go down as far as... there was Flensburg, which was up there, and it was Rendsburg down below at the bottom of the...
And what were you doing? Transport
whatever,
duties?
Whatever came up as a transport driver. And apart from helping out in this phony canteen that we had. And
what about some of the characters? I mean, what did you, I mean, we've gone past it a bit, but perhaps going back, what did you think of people like Huskinson, you know, your old squadron commander?
While you were out, I looked at the page that was open, and I realised out of A squadron there was only two of the original officers left at the end of the war. That was Huskinson and Brownlee.
And what did you think of those two?
Brownlee, I used to like him. It was only when he left that he got illusions of plenty. But mind you, he ended up as a full colonel.
What was he like?
He was a very, very handsome man and a very nice guy, but suddenly he got illusions of grandeur. Pinky, I didn't particularly like.
What didn't you like him for? I mean,
Pinky, I don't know what it was. It was something about him that he always seemed. He wasn't very. Well, he is now because I saw him on the telly. He's blown up like a balloon. But at the time, he was very slender and very insignificant as an officer. And, but no, I don't know what it was. Maybe I was one of these people that liked Powell much more than him. He did one thing earlier on in the war when we were in France, which I did admire him for, but I never got the answer, the true answer. In the field that we were in, the echelon, at the time, there was a tank knocked out in the next room. And obviously it had been one of ours. It had been burned out, blackened. And I'm assuming the best of Pinky at this point. And if it was as I thought, I had admired him for what he did. And he came across and he had a word with the CQMS. ATMS. Yeah. And he came out of there with 4 gas capes under his arm. You know, the loose gas capes that were all he did because we never had any gas, fortunately. So we used them as Macintoshes, really. But Pinky came out with about 4 of these under his arm, brand new ones. And he went out and he wandered over to where this tank was. Now, I'm assuming that he had the guts to get into that tank and left the bodies out. I don't know whether he did or not. But I assume when he got these gas capes, that what he did, and if he did, well, anything I've said to him in the past, it was out the window.
Any other officers that you sort of remembered very well? Lieutenant Heald or
no.
Miller, Porter? They're all
A. A lot of them came through after Goodwood. A lot of them came after
Goodwood. That's right, those. Do you remember any of them in particular?
Only this one fellow that doesn't seem to be on that list, which was... Bollers.
Captain Bollers, yes, he's on earlier on, yeah.
Yeah, well, he must have got knocked out somewhere.
What about any of the sergeants? I mean, some of them I know you know now, like Valance. What were that? Any sergeants or tank commanders you were in touch with?
As I say, I was... The tank crews that we meet lived in a world of 5 of them. And they just lived that little world. I didn't. I was standing outside. And
now the next thing then is when you were posted to the 5th Royal Tank Regiment. That's end of October.
Yeah. That was a joke as well.
What do you remember of that?
I remember that very clearly.
You were a tank driver then,
yeah,
weren't you?
Yeah.
And that.
But I hadn't had any driving experience for months. But I was posted as a tank driver
with B Squadron. You think?
So anyway, we got
5th Royal Tank Regiment.
So we went there, and we were lined up there, and
whereabouts? Sorry, Wilster. It's got here Wilster, in Ham.
Yeah, which was the next place down from Bradstead. Yeah, from Bradstead. And anyway, I don't know how many miles it was. Well, you know, you lose track of time. Of distance, it wasn't very far away, I don't think. And we were lined up there, you know, sort of, in a baggage sort of form order. And this, I remember, here's the officer I'm talking about now, a fellow named John Gwillam. And he was untidiest officer I've ever seen in my life. And he came out, and he was one of these supercilious sods. And he said, and he gave us a very, you know, sort of sneering sort of one sort of, and he said, and I was the only one with a divisional sign on, I see some of you have been in armour divisions of a sort before, which rattled me when they couldn't, none of these other regiments, which now was posted to the 7th Army, could hold a candle to anything the 11th had done. So anyway, I let that go, and it was getting on near Christmas time when I went there, surely. Or was it?
According to that, it's 31st of October.
Yeah, well, okay, we're not far off Christmas time.
And how did you settle in that unit?
I settled in all right with most of them. A lot of them were in the process of being demobbed anyway, as, you know, the number had come up. And basically, I got on very well with them because I treated them as a family. And shortly after I was there, we were put on a charge, I think 6 of us, and went before the Major, Major Coulson, I think his name was.
What for? What was the charge for?
Well, missing off First Parade. So anyway, went there, in front of, we'd only been there a couple of days. So anyway, went there, and we marched in. It's the first time I'd ever been in on a charge in my life. So I went in, and he said, oh, what are you got? Now, I was the only one that came up with a sensible answer. The rest of them just tagged on to what I said. Same as him, sir. Same as him, sir. I said, well, for one thing, there's no revalley. You know, it didn't exist. The orderly sergeant would come round and wake you up if he's done everything he thought he would. And I said, but the thing that strikes me is that there's no place where they used to post company orders. Anyway, the outcome of it was we all got 7 days jankers. Now the sergeant there, the provost sergeant, was an ex, I mean, I'm not condemning the fellow from his lowly beginnings, he was dispatch rider, and when they were all getting demobbed, they made him provost sergeant, big jump, and he was an absolute pig of a man. So we were told to report some, got jankers, so, and I never got jankers, and he did his damnedest to get me on an extra charge. But I had got probably one of the most perfect sets of brasses that ever, you know, existed in the army, polished back and front, and he couldn't take anything out of them. And I'd opened my belt and said, let's have a look at the back of them. And he couldn't get them anything. So eventually, we did our 7 days, and I asked for another interview with the Major. And I went in, and I said, he said, when are you going to see me about? I said, well, you remember? He said, yes. So I said, well, I've done my 7 days. You know, you do your jankers, and then you can complain after. And I said, this is what I'm doing. And I said, I think it was very unfair what he did. I checked up in the squadron office the next day. And there was virtually nobody on that parade. What happened to the rest of them? And all the ones that were from the charge were in the intake. So I think that was a bit unfair to start with. And anyway, it went on and on and on. And I said, also, while I'm at it, I said, the officer welcomed us to the regiment. I said, I objected to the way he handled the parade. I said, I was most insulted, and so on and so on. And I didn't realise what I'd done, how daggers drawn the two divisions were. Because, you know, I mean, Erskine got, you know, sort of demoted on in the field. Some of the tricks he did, you know, just failing to, you know, keep up with the battle. And so they were very much, you know, downgraded from what we were. So he said, he listened to what I'm going to say, and he said, he did two strange things. He said, I've looked through your papers, he said, and the first thing I'd like to say to you, do you want to go on a fitter's course back to England? And he said, I said, no. No, sir. Why not? I said, well, it was the time when they were switching them from units to Remy, and I was very proud of my band. I thought, no way am I going to walk around with a Remy band on me. So I said, no, sir, no, thank you. So he said, do you want to get transferred to a different unit? I.e. the 5th Dragoon Guards. I said, no. No, I said, I'll have my share of young one of the guards. You know, that's it. Because in the Scouts were the same thing as that. But were still, they were still, you know, the 1st Brigade, they blowed up their stables. You know, instead of go back, go to your tank park. So I said, no. So he tried everything and he said, well, you know, are you settling? I said, I've said the piece. And I said, now I will settle in. Because I said, so he said, oh, yeah, okay. And he was a very nice major, understand? He said, I appreciate what you said. And he said, any time that you think there's something sensible to say, come and see me. So, I got on the right foot with him. And then we stayed there for quite some time.
And what were you doing? Hmm? What were you were driving a tank. What sort of things were you doing day to day?
I didn't do very much at all. We were on a tank park, but I was given a tank. And I said, that's yours. And I think they actually they were the old tanks that we'd handed in.
The Comets. Yeah.
The Comets. We ran them around occasionally. And eventually we got a new officer. His name was the same as mine. Christian name, so it was Lieutenant Douglas, so he put me as his driver, and I could drive those things from too, because we went in common. We were going past RHQ one day, and he said, I thought he said, or I said, don't go on the pavement. No, I thought he said, don't go on the pavement, it hadn't, so the Colonel's car was outside. Go on the pavement. And apparently I skimmed again, it's car by about them. It was a very good judge you win. Oh my God, he's hitting nearly 100 half the time. So I said, so anyway, this Brownlee fella bought us for some time. And we were coming out of, Christmas Day it was, we were coming out of the cookhouse. And we were walking down the road, and this Brownlee walked past him. And he, from the back, he looked like a sack of spuds tied up in the middle. And we had this Percy Roberts with us, and he passed him, and he ignored him. And he said, Trooper, did you not realise I was an officer? He said, and Percy paid him, and he said, no, sir, I'm sorry, I didn't see, I waited to get them back from the repair. And he said, I didn't see the insignia on your shoulder. He said, well, is that your excuse? And then he came out of the corridor. He said, no, sir, but I can usually tell an officer by his smart and soldier-like bearing. Well, I thought, oh, my dear, you're not going to get away with that. And he did. This officer didn't know what the hell to say. And, he did. He pulled two or three things on. And we said to him one day, hey, Percy, you had him to the rifle competition. So he said, what do you mean? He said, you're up on a company officer. Report with a rifle and have set rations. So he goes storming into the major, into the evening, and he went in. He said, it's no good sending me on a rifle course, sir. I haven't got my glasses back. So he said, that's all right, Roberts. He said, it's a firing squad you're going on. Oh, I said, that's all right then. I haven't been on a firing squad before. Oh, I said, that's all right. So when he got back, I said, what was it like, Percy? He said, it was an education in itself. He said, they had a format, the way they did it. There were six of us, five or six of us. And he said, we all took our rifles with us from different units. And he said, we marched in and we were right turn. And then you grounded arms side of you. He said, and then we were marched away into another room. And I said, well, what happened then? So he said, well, they obviously came out and loaded the rifles. There was supposed to be one blank amongst the six. Well, it wasn't me that shot him, sir, if he had a conscience of sorts. So I said, well, what did you do then? So we said we will march back in, pick that answers off, and they drop. I took, I think, one man in, and there was a patch, you know, sort of over his heart, a 6-inch white patch. I said, did they tell you what they were executing him for? Oh, yeah, he said. He murdered a downed aircraftman, you know, trying to get a bayonet, and he murdered him, and they caught up with him, and he was being executed. So I said, well, what happened when you picked your rifle up? So he said that they'd been to the rifles and they'd boiled every one of them out, because you can tell whether it's an experienced soldier, you can tell whether it's had a bullet through or a blank. So he said none of us knew who'd done, you know, shooting. But that was one of the strange things. The next thing that happened, we were detailed to parade with our greatcoats on at this particular part, up near our HQ. So we came round and examined our greatcoats on and took our coats off. He said, right, we're picking out men for a corps guard. And invariably I would get picked for anything like that, because invariably, you know, you're thinking back, what sort of thing. Even when it was in the life again, I would invariably get a stick man on a guard, if you know what that is. Smartest man that money got actually was excuse the guard, but you did company running for the day. And he invariably got stick man. So anyway, we went there, and it was the most fabulous place I've ever seen in my life, and I don't know where. It was somewhere near Lundberg, and it was a German, like a medieval castle up a hill, and it was absolutely fabulous. And we had to patrol it, and like two of us. We had a guard mountain down in the village square, and then marched up, you know, the lonely. And we were walking around one night, and I said, we went over to where the colonel had his own private house within the grounds. And he's a little bit, he's a CB so-and-so, and he said, we're walking about, I'm supposed to be guarding him, the corps commander. He's got 6 CMPs sitting in the room outside him. So he said, you know what they're like, just carry on. Anyway, the next thing that happened, while we were still in Munster, I was told to report, and I don't know what it was, I know now, I think. It was a course for, not driver mech, it was a course for driver mech instructor. And it was another leg up, more pay again. And we went there, or I went there, there was nobody else in the room. And we were in a little village somewhere, and the food was absolutely fabulous. It was darn cold, but the food was absolutely...
Oh. And what were you being taught?
We were taught how to instruct other driver mechs. But the group I was posted to, a group of... I'm not anti-Semitic, anti-Jewish, whatever they call it. But the group I got with were a gang of these fairly new recruits that were, you know, you could tell them they were of the Jewish, you know, sort of standard. And we used to get an officer in and stand at the back of the class and listen to what we'd like to say. And this particular day, you'd have to get up in front and lecture on. Now, although I wasn't supposed to know all of that, I knew the Cromwell and the Comet inside out, and I could hold my own with anything that they like to throw at me. So this, you got to get a lecture, and I forget what it was, because they had a delivery slide and a scanning side on with the pumps in the engine, you know, the wonderful, you know, sort of intricacies of the Rolls Royce engine, and I knew it like the back of my hand, because actually we put it through a cooling radiator in the system. And I got it, and I decided I would do this what we call a scanning system. I got it and started to speed on. And I was told off after, he said, you did it very well, he said. And he said, that lot, the others, did the damage to throw you off your guard by asking irrelevant questions. And he said, you felt it every time. But he said, you not only felt it, but he said, you blinded him with science at the answer you gave. And he said, you should have said to him, you know, I'm telling you, I'm such a suit, this is my lecture. And he said, you were led astray by other people that wanted to make a monkey of you, and it didn't come off. So I said, oh, well. But anyway.